This town meeting concerns the media. Its title is Critiquing the Media, and will involve four panelists who are media specialists. They will make short statements, deliberating the subject among themselves, and then the audience will have an opportunity to question them. The distinguished panel includes Patrick Buchanan, speechwriter and assistant to President Nixon, Richard Goodwin, who formerly was a speechwriter and assistant to the late President Kennedy, and now is an editor of the publication Rolling Stone. Richard Harwood, the national affairs editor of the Washington Post. And Thomas Asher, director of the Media Access Project. The National Town Meeting is a new weekly forum that allows visitors to the nation's capital and Washington area residents the opportunity of hearing and then questioning prominent figures who speak here on some of the most vital public issues of the day. It's hoped that these national town meetings will help promote mutual understanding between American citizens and figures who have achieved prominence and expertise in the fields the public is concerned about. And now, the moderator of the national town meeting, Mr. John Daly.
Good morning. This is the fifth forum in our series, National Town Meeting, a title, by the way, which comes out of our conviction that the town meeting of the formative years of our great republic was as nearly perfect an instrument for the practice of democracy, government by the people, as man has ever devised. In nearly 200 years, we have grown enormously in size, in numbers, in complexity, in understanding and knowledge, and sadly, we have lost the intimacy and close communication of those remarkable gatherings in town hall, except in the still small towns from Tilton, New Hampshire to St. Helena, California, which still luxuriate in the grand tradition, government by the people in its purest form. Those of us in the great urban centers or satellite to them have to improvise to take advantage of the near miracle of instant communication harvested in this electronic age. We must develop new means of participating in the learning, sharing, and decision-making of the democratic process. We are, therefore, met in the Eisenhower Theater of the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center in the Capitol to create a public forum. And National Public Radio is broadcasting our meeting live throughout the nation. This series, our National Town Meeting, is made possible by a grant from the Mobil Oil Corporation, which, as many of you know, also supports Masterpiece Theater on the public television network. In addition, here at Kennedy Center with us in the Eisenhower Theater are some of the tens of millions from all over the nation who come to Washington, D.C. each year to get closer to their government, to glory in the monuments to the past, and to get a better sense and feeling of the triumphs and failures of the present times. What we hope to do is bring the leaders and the issues out of the offices, the agencies, the courts, and the committees of the Congress here to meet and to talk with, not talk to talk with the visitors to the Capitol and you on the National Public Radio Network. Now, our subject this morning is a critique of the media, a large subject area demanding a broad perspective. Accordingly, we've modified our usual format. Four highly qualified observers will offer the issue in brief opening statements, after which a general dialogue among the four, with questions from our audience here at town meeting, will, we hope, present a fruitful, candid, and earnest view of an issue very much in the public mind in the light of recent events and the major part the media have played in them. Our observers are Mr. Patrick Buchanan, formerly of the St. Louis Globe Democrat, an articulate critic of advocacy journalism, and now special consultant to President Nixon, overseeing, among other things, the preparation of the daily presidential news summary. Mr. Richard Harwood, formerly of the Nashville Tennessean, Louisville Courier Journal and Times, and now national affairs editor of the Washington Post. He has, by the way, a rather particular knowledge of the public reaction to the print media, having served as ombudsman of the Washington Post as a direct communications link between his paper and its subscribers. Mr. Richard Goodwin, now senior editor of Rolling Stone, former law clerk to the late Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, assistant special counsel to President John F. Kennedy and special assistant to President Lyndon Johnson, and Mr. Thomas Asher, the executive director of the Media Access Project, a public interest law firm focusing on the communications field. Mr. Asher played a major role in the recent reforms moved by the Hughes and then the McGovern committees, for instance, a major role in the recent reforms in the elective machinery and methodology of both major parties. Now, as we come to questions, I will, if necessary, try to be helpful with respect to the electronic media, in which I served as a CBS and ABC correspondent for some 16 years and then as ABC vice president in charge of news for 8 years. Well, that sets the stage. And Mr. Buchanan, if you please.
Before entering into any critique of the media, I think it's important to first define just who and what is the big media that we're discussing today. Basically, there are three national networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, that control each of them, five major market stations, hundreds of affiliates. Each of them reaches 50 million, together they reach 50 million Americans nightly with their version of the news. It's been estimated that some 60% of the American people rely upon these news media as their primary source of information and news and ideas about their government, their nation, and the world. Secondly, there's the New York Times. New York Times is the first paper read in the world's media capital. It's the first paper that's read in the network news offices. It's the second paper that's read in every capital of the world. And in addition, the Times, through the New York Times News Service, disseminates its ideas, news columns, editorials, and columns into all 50 states of the Union. The third I would like to discuss is the Washington Post Company, which is a true communications conglomerate. The Washington Post Company controls not only the largest newspaper in the nation's capital, the only morning paper, it controls WTOP television, a major television station in the nation's capital, controls an all-news radio station, it controls Newsweek magazine, one of the two major national news weeklies, it controls beyond that the Washington Post, or has a half interest in the Washington Post, LA Times News Service, which is a competitor of the Associated Press, and along with the Times, it has a controlling interest in the International Herald Tribune, so that no American, even if he's in Western Europe, is really outside the range of influence of the Washington Post Company. Now, these three networks, two newspapers, companies, along with Time Inc., I would suggest, are the dominant major media in the United States. They are decisive in dictating how this nation, this government, and this world will be presented daily and weekly to the American people. In the definition of Karl Marx, power used to be control of the means of production. As Arthur Schlesinger has observed, and correctly, I believe, power today is control of the means of communications. Now, these six major corporations control and dominate communications in the United States. And it is my belief, and that of journalists from Robert Novak to Howard K. Smith to Jack Kilpatrick, that these institutions, these six institutions, and the small handful of men who make the decisions on what is news daily, they have a particular bias, a particular point of view. Let me quote Mr. Novak. The national media is a melting pot where the journalists, regardless of background, are welded into an homogeneous ideological mold, joined to the liberal establishment, and alienated from the masses of the country. In my judgment, this is one of the most serious and searing social issues of our time, is that in the major democracy of the West, the major democracy of the world, the means of communications are in control of a handful of like-minded individuals. How is that bias manifest? I suggest in a variety of ways. First, especially on the networks, in the treatment that is accorded the American business community. 5 out of 6 Americans are in the private sector, not in the government sector. 2/3 of our gross national product comes from this sector. American business, American industry, are responsible, partially certainly, for the tremendous prosperity of American society. Yet how is American business portrayed on the networks nightly? The only time you'll see a businessman, almost invariably, on the network news is when he's being investigated, his factory is polluting some river, or perhaps his profit margins have reached a point where they must be noticed with disdain by some network commentator or anchorman whose own income ranges upwards of $250,000 a year. Secondly, the networks in their and the national news media have a particular bias against, in favor of federal spending and against cutbacks in any federal services, with a single exception of the military. Time and again, the Nixon administration, whether it was the OEO program, a legal services program, or some other program, would attempt to cut back, and invariably that evening you could find on the network news or the next week special spliced separate report which showed the benefits of that particular program and was in effect an editorial against government policy in that area. Third, and most important, the networks and the national news media give enormous positive and favorable publicity to political movements associated with the far left. By that, I would note the anti-war movement, the consumer movement, the civil rights movement. And there is a double standard. Okay. See, we're not playing for a hometown crowd. Let me give you some examples. I think this manifests itself in something of a double standard in dealing. You all recall, those of you who lived in Washington, not the tourists, that on the May Day demonstrations here, the city of Washington, there was an effort made by thousands of demonstrators to close down the city, and in effect, Georgetown and other areas of the cities were badly trashed. Following that, the national news media made a conscientious effort, or took the side of the demonstrators, in effect, suggesting that the proper arrest forms were not filled out, the demonstrators had been badly treated. Now, suppose those had been the supporters of George Wallace, who had been trashing the city of Georgetown. I suggest to you the reaction would have been otherwise. The same is true when the Bureau of Indian Affairs was pillaged and almost destroyed, $2 million of damage done by the members of the American Indian Movement. Suppose those had been members of the Ku Klux Klan. Would there have been that much of a call for sympathy and understanding? I suggest not. Let us take Mr. Walter Mondale, who receives outsized publicity today by virtue of the fact that Mr. Mondale's positions are consistent with those, I suggest, of the Washington Post. Why does not Mr. Lloyd Benson, Senator Lloyd Benson of Texas, get equal publicity? Let me consider Mr. William Cohen now, Republican Judiciary Committee. If Mr. Cohen votes for impeachment, then Mr. Cohen has it made so far as the national media is concerned. He will be ballyhooed, he will be on the networks, he will be on the front page, the style section, and the editorial section of the Washington Post. If he opposes impeachment, Mr. William Cohen will be ignored. That is a prediction. Let me take another issue. The Urban Committee this weekend came out with its report. One of its primary recommendations, the only recommendation, quite frankly, that deals with campaign reform that is extant this year, was its opposition, 5-2, to public funding. That news story, I suggest, was buried in the pages of the Eastern Press because, by and large, the Eastern Press, even though it supports Senator Irwin, it also supports public funding, and that is why it was buried. Let me take one more example, and I'm sure this will raise the hackles of the audience from what has taken place thus far. Mrs. Virginia Nauer, who among the consumerists and the environmentalists and the others, in my judgment, stands out like Mother Teresa of Calcutta. This last Monday in the Washington Post, Mrs. Nauer came out and endorsed the Consumer Protection Agency currently being debated in Congress in the Senate. That endorsement is not unusual. Mrs. Nauer is a consumerist. That endorsement was played on page one of the Washington Post, played very high. The reason I suggest is because Mrs. Nauer is supporting a position that the Washington Post also supports. But there are other things about the Consumer Protection Agency which have gone largely unreported or unnoted. That is, first, that the arm twisting of Mr. Ralph Nader and the intimidation being practiced on Capitol Hill is certainly in excess of anything attempted by the Chamber of Commerce. Secondly, the consumer, one or two, Chamber of Commerce over here. Secondly, this is special interest legislation. It's actually a slice of pork barrel for Mr. Nader. The most immediate, the most direct beneficiaries of that Consumer Protection Agency will not be consumers. They will be the individuals, the 250 individuals who will be hired, put on government payrolls, given job security, given power, given perquisites, and given publicity. I suggest that those individuals are cohorts of Mr. Ralph Nader so that this is special interest legislation. Third, the defeat of the CPA, in my judgment, would be a victory for the American consumer. The last thing this country needs right now in the time of double-digit inflation is yet another agency of gung-ho federal bureaucrats whose job is to harass other bureaucrats who are not doing the job that Congress assigned them to do. Lastly, a final note. In correcting media bias, in my judgment, the government has no business intervening in the privileged sanctuary of a newsroom. For that reason, I would support, and I believe the Supreme Court was wise when it ruled unanimously in the Tornillo decision that newspapers should not be required to provide balance in their news columns and that the government has no role there. Any role that government has should be dealing with the corporate structure of these media institutions because of their size, because of the nature of these conglomerates, and government should keep its hands out of the newsroom. Thank you very kindly.
Mr. Harwood. Newspapers are somewhat like politicians these days. They arouse very strong emotions, as we can see. And I think sometimes the facts don't always get in the way of those emotions. And I suspect there's no set of facts that I could put together that will persuade Pat to love the Washington Post, but that's... Any case, as we go along here today, we ought to keep a couple of things in mind. I'm glad Pat raised the question of the treatment of business and so forth. Newspapers are businesses. We are free enterprises. Unlike some businesses, we do not live off government largesse, and we do not dance to a government tune. We compete in the marketplace for our readers, for our advertisers, just as politicians compete in the marketplace for votes. And we get a mandate, and it's not every 4 years, it's every day. The second fact I would point out is that despite Pat's preoccupation with Octopus Inc., which is this Eastern liberal cabal, we are part of a very diverse business. There are approximately 1,700 daily newspapers in America. There are 8,000 weeklies, 10,000 periodical magazines and journals, and 5,000 broadcasting stations. And they do not speak in one voice, as some would have you believe. As a matter of fact, most of them speak in the voice of the Nixon administration. In the last campaign, I think of all the newspapers supporting a candidate, something like 80 to 90, wasn't Pat, supported this administration. As to the matter of size, if you take the revenues of all the newspapers, all the broadcasting stations together, you get something like $12 to $15 billion a year. I would suggest that the General Motors Corporation, which is one company, has revenues of $36 billion a year. And Pat's company, which is the federal government, has revenues of $300 billion a year. So I'm not as impressed with the charges of giantism and monopoly as some are. In any event, we are business enterprises, and we survive on the goodwill of our customers and not on the goodwill of the government. The second point I would make is that, as between the press and the government, we are greatly outnumbered. There are approximately 17 million government employees in this country, and there are approximately 40,000 newspaper reporters and editors. Of that number, only about 300 are employed by the Washington Post, which is a rather small band in comparison to the forces Mr. Buchanan represents. He represents Leviathan, an enormous apparatus that has the power to make war or peace, to raise or lower the living standards of every American citizen, to impress us into military service, to send us to prison, to tax our incomes, to affect in meaningful ways every aspect of our lives. The press has no armies, and the press has no red buttons to push. So when we think about power in America, I think we ought to think seriously about who has it. I'll turn now to the... question at hand, which is critiquing the media. What we're talking about, I suppose, is the question of how well we do our job. And there is no simple answer. The diverse businesses that make up the press in this country serve all kinds of audiences. My own newspaper has more audiences than we can count: urban, rural, suburban, young, old, blacks, whites, Hispanics, politicians, diplomats, bureaucrats, presidents, Redskin fans, comic readers, and all the rest. And I think when you get into the question of how well we do our job, you have to see, try to answer the question of how well do we serve each of these audiences. It's quite true that the White House may feel we don't serve their interests very well. It's quite true that other elements in the community will have criticism of our coverage. But our problem is to serve a diverse audience, in our own case with a smorgasbord every morning, and to sell that product in the market. And I think it's the market that is the ultimate judge of our efficiencies. Another thing you have to consider in this kind of exercise is how well do we do our job, and that is compared to what? It was said that democracy is the worst form of government devised except for all others. And I suppose that is true of the free press. We are like all institutions in this country, imperfect. And the public recognizes that. The most recent poll I've seen on the subject ranks the media somewhere in the middle of the large institutions in the country, just below the public schools and just above the Supreme Court. At the top of that list was the U.S. military. At the bottom was the president and his administration. So the American people, in their great wisdom, take a mixed view toward the media, and so do I. Our performance is uneven, and as we go along here, we will no doubt get into specifics. I've said for years that a newspaper is no more infallible in what it produces every day than General Motors or Corner Delicatessen. Our fallibilities are very legitimate objects of public interest and discussion, and I welcome that. There's one caveat that I always keep in my own mind, and that is that when the Constitution was written, providing for a free press, there was nothing in that amendment or in the minds of its authors that guaranteed this country good newspapers or liberal newspapers or conservative newspapers or Democratic or Republican newspapers. All that was guaranteed was that the press should be free. And that is all the Constitution promised us as individuals. Not that we would be good or bad or rich or poor people, but that we would be free. I suppose that we'll be getting into political discussion as we go along, which is unfortunate, because I think the really serious problems about the performance of the press are not the politics of a particular newspaper or commentator, but the quality and the relevance of the information that the media provide this society. And maybe we can talk about that, too. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Goodwin.
I For listening to Pat Buchanan, I can understand how he was the author of the famous anagram, isn't it, P.O., or Presidential Offensive, which means that if you're caught with your hand in someone else's pocket, you immediately blame them for trying to seduce you to commit an unnatural act. I can only conclude from his remarks that the elections of President Nixon in 68 and 72 against this immense power must have been fraudulent and demanded immediate recount. Although I think I sympathize with Pat, too, if I could add 1 minute to my presentation, I think his position recalled to me immediately the Irish paratrooper from my native city of Boston who was sent up for his first jump and was told, you jump out and the parachute opens. If it doesn't work, you pull the emergency chute. If it doesn't work, there's a special ripcord. You pull that, and then when you get down on the ground, there'll be a wagon waiting to take you to a dinner of corned beef and cabbage. He got up and he jumped. Chute didn't open. He pulled the ripcord. It didn't work. Pulled the special emergency. It didn't work. He looked down at the ground and said, bet that darn wagon won't be there either. But I do hope he gets good meal anyways, Pat. It is easy in reflex reaction to what is obviously a great disparity of political views to find yourself in the position of actually defending the media. I found when Agnew was attacking at one point that I was even defending network television, which was a brand new experience for me. And I don't want to fall into that today if we're talking about the press. I think that one thing the press never needs, really, is praise. It may need defense against efforts to oppress it, control it. But it needs also, I think, the constant stimulation and attack that will enable it and force it to provide the kind of job that it can do. I think that I just wanted to touch on in this opening statement two or three of the basic inadequacies of media, of the press, especially of the press, television being almost beyond any rational discussion since it's only able to prevent in very brief form the sort of summaries of what appears in the New York Times and Washington Post along with pictures, so that the source of news in this country, of the substance of news, if not the image of news, which is more Mr. Buchanan's concern than mine at this moment in time, is the newspapers. First, they find themselves unable to tell the truth because of the conventions of journalism, which go under the terms of objectivity, unbiased, the idea of balance, which means that if a group of blacks say they're oppressed, then on the other hand, you quote the Ku Klux Klan as saying it's not true, they're not oppressed, and then you have a balanced news story. Now, those conventions assume, and I think we heard this from what Mr. Howard said, that you really can represent the entire community. That's sort of like being president of all the people. It assumes there are no irreconcilable differences of interests and opinion, and it also assumes that somehow the truth is always found halfway in between opposing points of view, which of course is not true at all in many cases. Partly that comes from the growing monopoly nature of newspapers within the community. They may not be as large as General Motors, but within their field and within their cities, a paper like the Washington Post or the Boston Globe in my hometown do dominate the news and the flow of news as much as General Motors dominates the flow of automobiles within those cities. And that's, of course, the market. That is the relevant area of interest in the market in which it counts. And so that this stress, this withdrawal from the assertion of opinion, of conviction by the journalist and by the newspaper, the idea that you can only present the facts as if there were any such thing when you're really dealing nothing but contrasting opinions, really deprives people of the insight that newspapermen themselves might have and of an eye at the truth. The ideal news lead, in my opinion, might very well be, for example, Hubert Humphrey addressed the National Education Association today and spoke nonsense for 30 minutes. That would at least, and of course, that would, for a moment at least, give people some insight into what every reporter knows. In any event, the second thing, and that applies, of course, to newspapers everywhere in the country. The second thing is the fact that newspapers, I think, are imprisoned in official Washington to a large extent by the fact that they are dealing with officials and must write what they say and do. Now, I speak as one who has been, as Mr. Buchanan has, on the other end of news management, of an effort to influence the press in the favor of the government and administration. And assumes many techniques. There was a difference between the way we cultivated the press then, and we were under the mistaken apprehension that you could get favorable news by being nice to the press, whereas they discovered there was much more to be gained by being mean to them. Yeah, which only proves that fear is a more powerful emotion than affection, at least in Washington. But what it means, for example, is that if a high official says something, all the press and the reporters feel compelled to print the next day, a high official said, and then run the story. Whether or not what he said is true or has any factual basis, whether or not the press itself has done any independent investigation, or even if they know or suspect it to be false. A classic example was Kissinger's statement just before the 72 election that peace was at hand, printed rather and run rather uncritically, especially by the New York Times, which quite often it has always had a few members of its Washington Bureau that have viewed themselves as part of the diplomatic corps of the United States. But it's this use, the printing of official statements, of official news, as if they were true, with only the phrase, according to warn the highly sophisticated from their, which in a way makes the press, is one of the techniques by which the press itself can become imprisoned in official Washington. This is not a new phenomenon. H.L. Mencken in the 1920s wrote that any city editor worth his salt would change his Washington correspondent every 6 months. He thought that no one could really stay here that long without becoming corrupted in some way. Yeah. And in the 1920s, I understand, this was a rather bucolic place compared to what it is has been since the New Deal. In any event, that's another, the third and most important thing, and I think, again, we see this runs through Mr. Howard's talk, is that the press itself has become large, are themselves large economic institutions. They are concerned. We've heard the words market, product, consumer, sale running through it. Therefore, they automatically share, even without, not in any express form, the kinds of ideologies and values which dominate the society as a whole. If, in fact, they want to represent the Eastern financial establishment, it's not because of personal links, but it is because it would be because of the economic power of that establishment. So that they are part, really, of the governing, the large media, part of the governing apparatus of this country. Their members sit on the board of directors of other corporations. Their essential problems are economic. They are a business and a product, and a large one, a bureaucratic one. And although many individual members of the press are not in any way consciously propagandizing for the dominant economic institutions of the United States, they live within the milieu where these assumptions are shared. This is the kind of process which has led us to the point, for example, in which the idea of controls on inflation has not only been rejected, but discredited in the eyes of the American people. Now, whether or not you believe in controls on inflation, at least, and I think that you can hardly think of any other way to control it, there should be a different kind of debate going on in the media about this issue, which is, in the minds of the American people, the most important issue in America today. That you find the deterioration of the real income of Americans, drop in their standard of living, and yet somehow this is almost as if there's been a tacit agreement that, well, we know one thing won't work, it's control. And that results not from conspiracy, but from shared assumptions. The same thing with the death of tax reform. Despite the 1972 campaign, despite the energy crisis, right now the interests, private interests in the Hill are successfully, and will be successful, in destroying any effective tax reform. And there are items, but of course this is something of major consequence. It's something of enough major consequences that was able to arouse the emotions and the passions of the American people strongly in the primaries in 1972. And yet, it's not because the press is against tax reform, but simply because they are, from their position as large economic institutions, unable to take up this issue with the kind of passion that they can bring to the more classical scandals and perhaps in some ways smaller scale scandals of a Watergate. And, of course, one of the examples, most direct examples, is now the new broadcasting bill, which is mentioned but not very much in the press, which will make it almost impossible to chaff for any public interest group to challenge television licenses, and which is being put through partly by the lobbying pressure of the mass media themselves, which, whatever your view about their right to represent their interests, here clearly have a conflict of interest between their duty as journalists to report what's being done to the public and their interest as economic institutions in protecting their very valuable kinds of franchises. Because that direct thing is rare and not what I'm talking about. And there really is no escape from the kind of institutions and ideas which rule the society. They also rule all big institutions within it, including the press. However, the press is not the same as General Motors and not the same as the United States government. There is a diversity. There are clashes. And it's through those openings that the press performs its service. There is no way to try to control the press in any direct way to make it better. It naturally would be oppressive and only make it worse. The only way is to increase diversity, whether it's the underground newspaper, alternative presses, the dissolution of television networks, growth of public broadcasting, in the hopes that the more voices there are, the more opportunity there will be to get at the truth, or more important, get at the meaning of what is happening and what is being to us. So that I think, is my critique of the press, and that if this kind of diversity comes about, it won't be given to us by either Mr. Buchanan or the Washington Post, but be created through the demand and efforts of people in this city, which lacks an alternative newspaper, even one, and throughout the country. So that, I think, is the job of press criticism. Thank you.
And now, may I remind the audience that your questions are wanted, and if you have them, please write them on the cards which have been furnished to you. They will be collected and brought here, and we will, after the final position statement, go to an open invitation to join the dialogue of our distinguished guests. And the final position statement by Mr. Asher, please.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief, in part because I agree with most of Dick Goodwin's remarks, in part because I think that talking too much about the press has a tendency to become very, very abstract. We get away from the question, the sort of hard factual questions that Mr. Buchanan posed, such as, does the president get adequate coverage or not? Is big business being shafted in its coverage on the press or not, and instead talk about the more abstract and, in the long run, more real questions of the First Amendment, of press freedoms, of bias, of informing the public at large, all of which are the real questions, but I think that they don't lend themselves to grappling, at least in this format, in very short presentations. So I'll try to cite a number of what I regard as specific examples to illustrate a few of these major, more apparently general and abstract points. I'll beg your indulgence for a moment. I left a quotation here. Mr. Buchanan is so eminently quotable that I thought it might be worth starting out by going back to his words again and sort of reviving the vitality of the discussion. He stated not too long ago that in bringing about the current general decline in confidence in government, the national media must be named, in that happy Watergate phrase, a, quote, non-indicted co-conspirator. Well, I think there's a general decline in government, and I think the facts speak for themselves, and the public can judge whether it's really the media that's to blame, or it's the folks who are running the government. I think that that the realities of modern day life are such that even if the government controlled the press, which I think would be probably the most horrible result of all, even if Mr. Buchanan's office in the White House controlled the press, there would have been no way to have concealed from the American public the facts, the real facts, which have led to the decline in confidence of the government. I suggest, therefore, that that's a good place to start. What if? Mr. Buchanan said he has a commitment to the First Amendment and no government meddling in the newsroom. At the same time, Mr. Buchanan in the White House has a long-run hostility to what's going on in the newsroom, long-run efforts to punish what's going on in the newsroom, such as offering Daniel Shore of CBS an environmental job. At least that was the cover for going out and digging into Mr. Shore's records, and on and on, which I need not list. But of all the dangers that we face, and certainly my work has been from the point of view of critiquing and criticizing and hassling and litigating against the press on behalf of public interest groups. So I regard the press as an enemy to a degree. But of all of the dangers that we face, the biggest danger is coming from where Mr. Buchanan is at. And I think that should be kept in mind. Perhaps the next point is to try to get a grip on who has access to the press and who doesn't, who can get their views heard regardless of what a journalist wants to write about them or not, and who can't. Mr. Buchanan listed several disadvantaged folks, disadvantaged interests in this country, people who have been left begging by the bias in the press. Business. We can't hear the views of business. We're suffering because we, the American public, are suffering because we're not being told the views of American business. All we hear about, in Mr. Buchanan's words, are about one polluting factory. That's the only time we hear about the views of business. Well, anyone who looks at the press has to realize what Dick Goodwin pointed out. This is a commercial medium, and commercialism means that the bills are paid by advertising, and who advertises? Well, if it's not business, I don't know who it is. And I've heard enough of business's views on everything. In the middle of an energy crisis, we heard business's views on why we should buy electric appliances ranging from soup to nuts at a time when we couldn't deliver electricity. So I would suggest that the public is not being terribly shortchanged as to the views of business. Now, on the other side of the coin, it's not business is being shortchanged, according to the government, but the people who are getting excessive exposure are consumerists, environmentalists, and so on. I think this is a very, very serious problem, since most of my clients are consumerists, environmentalists, who feel they're being shut out of the media. And to pick up, I hate to make it a personal vendetta, but I guess I disagree with more of what Mr. Buchanan said than what anyone else said, so I focus on his remarks not out of any personal hostility, just trying to deal with the issues he raised. He was concerned with the Chamber of Commerce against Ralph Nader. The Chamber of Commerce and Ralph Nader are going to war on a number of issues. One of them is strip mining, another is the Consumer Protection Agency. Strip mining legislation, which is now being debated on the floor of the House, the Chamber, together with the administration, is opposed to strict environmental standards. Nader is on the other side, along with some environmental groups, and the split is fairly sophisticated. The Chamber has a lot of money. Chamber puts out a weekly radio program that reaches 700 to 800 stations, distributed free and broadcast as a, quote, public service, close quote, by these stations. Number 864 of which hit the airways around June 30th, had a 20-minute discussion between Arch Booth, president of the Chamber of Commerce, and Representative Craig Hosmer, the leading spokesman for the Chamber of Commerce's side of this strip mining legislation. It got on free on every one of these stations, most of whom hadn't even listened to what it was about. Now, there's something called a fairness doctrine that says if you put on one side of a controversial issue, you have to put on the other. And when we approached these stations and told them what they put on the air, including the Mutual Radio Network, they said, oh, my gosh, we put that on? Well, we'll give you some response time. I was representing Patsy Mink, Congressman Patsy Mink, who is one of the leading spokespersons on the other side. She got on. She wouldn't have gotten on if some environmentalist hadn't gotten up at 6:30 in the morning and heard this Chamber of Commerce program on the radio. The fact is that we don't have to worry about the Chamber of Commerce. They have the money. They have an estimated $20 million a year for lobbying in Washington, and they very effectively get their views communicated, in part through the complicity of the press, because the press, as Mr. Goodwin has pointed out, is there taking the handouts from the folks that have enough money to have a big mimeograph machine, a big PR operation, and can push their views. So I don't worry too much about the chamber. Next concern is, what about the administration? Well, if the Chamber of Commerce, with its $20 million a year, can hire a lot of lobbyists, a lot of public relations firms, and a lot of public relations men or women, and a whole lot of media time, what about the administration? It can buy up even more than General Motors. And I think that if we start to look at the type of media coverage, I'd like to focus more on the broadcast than the print media. Dick Goodwin talked about the broadcast media as being sort of beyond comment, and maybe I'm revealing some arrogance in trying to comment on them. But think for a moment about the way in which the broadcast media, especially the national networks, are serving the administration. The administration may not like the coverage it's getting in news. It may think Walter Cronkite sneers when he says, "The president said." And that sneer has devastated the president beyond any capacity to counterattack. Well, let's take a look at the way the president can counterattack. The president can say, "I want to speak to the American people." And the three networks simultaneously bow down and say, "How much time would you like? Where should we set up the cameras? You control the format. You control the content of what you say. Anytime." Wants to hold a press conference, same thing. Let's talk about these talks to the American people, simultaneously on the three networks. Usually, that leaves you nothing but reruns of Andy Hardy movies on the other stations to look at, so everybody watches it. He commands, therefore, enormous audiences, not commanded by any news program, not commanded by anything else. And what can the president do? There's no effort by the broadcasters to in any way suggest, "Well, we don't like your taking 25 minutes, 30 minutes, 35 minutes. Confine your remarks to 10. We don't want to interrupt All in the Family. No, as much time as you want. If you want to talk about Watergate and make a, quote, full disclosure, close quote, of the evidence, you can stack on a chair next to you, or a table, I'm not certain which it was, loose leaf notebooks, which in toto came to about 4 feet high, containing, quote, all the evidence, close quote." When the government printing office finally put out, quote, all the evidence, close quote, it put it out in a volume that was that high. The president was able to speak on uninterrupted, explain his side of the issue, and so on. I think that's fine. But the biggest concern that I've got is, what about people who disagree? I mean, they have to have something more to rely upon than Walter Cronkite's sneer. Or some vague perception that the news coverage is very hostile to the government on a day-in, day-out basis. Because if the president wants, he can, on a day-in, day-out basis, if he had something to say that was credible, he could commandeer that time day-in, day-out and put his side on. I suggest that one reason he has not is not that the media is giving him a hard time. They'll give him the time anytime he wants it, which is a very disturbing thought. If you're concerned about 1984 and mind control and who can grab your attention through the television screen on a regular basis. The reason he doesn't do it, I think, is that he may have run out of string after the last one, and he has to wait until something new comes up. But when he does, when he feels he wants it, the time is there. And remember that. So if the press is performing an unsatisfactory job in terms of getting all the views out, in terms of bias, I think the bias is coming from exactly the points that Mr. Goodwin identified. One, a definite bias in favor of the government. Because even if the press, print or broadcast, for that matter, disagrees with what the government is saying, it's going to report what the government is saying because the government has said it. And the government's critics, more often than not, have to take to the streets or do something violent or bizarre to make their contrasting viewpoint newsworthy. The defect in the press's view of what the news is, that the anti-war demonstrations illustrate, is that the anti-war people had to go to the streets, had to get crazy, had to rip things up in order to make their views newsworthy. And just remember that on the other side of the coin, the administration never had to take to the streets to make its views newsworthy. The president just had to have Herbert Klein or whoever else was sitting in that communications chair pick up the phone, call the networks, call the Washington Post, call all the wire service and say, the president's going to talk, come on over. He had it. I think that that's a much more serious problem. Problems of commercialism. How often in your daily newspaper, which in all but 35 odd communities in this country is monopoly owned, how often in your daily newspaper do you read of criticism of the people who buy the commercial space in that paper? How often do they tell you that Sears Roebuck has been preceded against by the National Organization for Women as being sexist? How often do they tell you that your local supermarket, which buys up enormous amounts of advertising, especially on Thursdays, so you'd never see it on Thursday, how often do you see that your local supermarket is selling shoddy merchandise or is overcharging or doesn't carry the sale merchandise, and so on? I would suggest that just to sum up, that it isn't business, that it isn't the federal government that's on the short end of the stick. It's mostly the consumer, the environmentalists, the folks who don't have the money to buy in big, can't buy a newspaper, certainly can't buy much advertising time. Political dissidents who can't make news the way those in control of the administration can. Even outsiders. It's been suggested recently that the press's hostility toward the president derives in large part from the fact that there isn't a strong adversarial relationship from the second party in this country. If, in fact, there is a strong adversarial relationship between the press and the administration, I would suggest that's healthy. That's the healthiest thing going on. All these other problems also warrant attention, too, and I suggest they not be swept under the rug. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I submit that in our four statements, we've had a substantial critique of the media, but what we really wanted to get to was what is in your minds, in our audience, and happily the questions have been coming up in some numbers. I will take the license of this position, if I may, to talk to one sentence that was spoken by Mr. Goodwin with respect to electronic journalism, which I spent my life. I think that our evening network news programs are, in effect, the front page and front section, the news section of a paper such as the Washington Post. And we do very broad coverage in the electronic field in other areas. Our documentaries are significantly, I think, in the record as having played a major part in informing the public about major issues. And, of course, the special programs on the occasion of any very substantial public question coming to the fore, the special programs, not even called documentaries, pick up, I think, what the other elements of the information area of a newspaper do rather than the entertainment areas of the newspapers. Now, let's get to the questions. This one comes from Sandy Greer, Albany, New York. It's addressed to the panel. So, gentlemen, you will all have a shot at it if you'd like. In your opinion, does the responsible reporter exceed his ethics when he offers the, quote, opportunity, close quote, to individuals to leak or divulge information that they have been especially charged to withhold by the court system? Example, the questioning of grand jurors by Post reporters Woodward and Bernstein. If you feel such questioning is unethical, why? If not, why not? Would you start, Mr. Harwood?
Yeah, I think the newspapers try to abide by the law. And the questioning of grand jurors is improper. As we all know, and it's improper. We don't do it.
I would concur. I think Woodward and Bernstein themselves felt it was unethical, and I think it is because the grand jury system is set up in such a way that breaching the secrecy of the grand jury in the exercise of the First Amendment freedom of the press at the same time violates other rights of other individuals. So I think it's unethical.
Mr. Goodwin?
Well, I suppose, I don't know if it's unethical, but I think it's illegal to do it. It's done all the time. For example, it was used, the grand jury minutes that we used to destroy the Biagi candidacy in New York City, linked to the New York Times, I think probably by the U.S. Attorney's Office. So it's not just the press, but even the government itself, which at times violates it. But of course, if it's illegal, I suppose that makes it improper.
Right. Mr. Asher?
Just to add some diversity here, I'm not terribly disturbed by it. At least not disturbed by reporters seeking out this information. It may be illegal under certain circumstances, but certainly not all. But what we're concerned with here is a government of excessive secrecy. And the seeking of grand jury information, the grand jury being one of the closed informational devices of the government, is not inherently so evil when you look at it in the context of a public that's been perpetually hoodwinked by government secrecy over the years.
Mr. Asher, are you equating grand jury proceedings, which are a part of our judicial branch of government, as practicing excessive secrecy?
Well, I think that the question was probably prompted by the Watergate grand jury. Now, the Watergate grand jury was being run by the Justice Department. Mr. Peterson in the Justice Department, who was in charge of it, was also meeting with the president on a daily basis. And they had contrived a method of trying to sweep information under the rug. The grand jury was trying to develop it. And I think if the reporters hadn't gotten what information they could, we might at the present day know far less about Watergate than we do. And I think it's healthy that we know about it.
Well, actually, what we...
I'd like to join that and say that of all the institutions in the government, the judiciary, I think, has come out of all this appearing most in service of the national interest. And that's partly, in large measure, because it has standards and values of conduct which are independent of political ideology and the momentary passions of the time. And I think if liberals want to erode those standards in the interest of immediate results, then we're going to all suffer for it very much in the long run.
Yes, I think, the thrust of the question is, was it unethical and why? If not, why not? And I would think that we should take the questions in the broadest possible aspect and leave them in that framework rather than in a very narrow framework, which would get us fighting about whether the end justifies the means. To Mr. Buchanan and the others, isn't it the duty of the media to have a sort of adversary relationship with the administration, to keep them on their toes? Is there such thing as a president who has been satisfied with his press coverage? Name one. Mike Panana, Ann Arbor, Michigan.
My answer to that would be yes, the press should be in an adversary posture with the administration. It is government's, one of government's functions, of course, is to maintain the confidentiality of its workings. One of press's functions is to explore and get as much information for the American people as they can. So I think that sort of adversary relationship is natural and it's justified. And I think, quite frankly, that in terms of press coverage, I would think that John F. Kennedy, although he complained some, had good reason to be satisfied with his press coverage, whereas Lyndon Johnson, for example, and Richard Nixon did not. And I think the basic reason, as I say, is that in this concentration, now, Mr. Goodwin mentioned that, or someone mentioned that some 85 publications or something like that, 85% endorse the president. But your national news, the news on which these publications depends, it comes out of Washington. It does not come out of 1,700 different sources. It comes out of a very tiny handful of sources. And if that handful of sources is informed by a particular general bias, and what the American people are is getting one side of the story, selected stories and the like, and that the whole country would be a good deal better off if there were a good deal more balance in the National Press Corps here in Washington, D.C.
Does anybody else wish to go to that?
Said in the old days, it used to be thought it was the government's responsibility to tell the American people what it was doing, and not really.
Well, I remember hearing once. Well, I tell you, why don't you come back after the program? Don't look for publicity now. Why don't you come back after the program? Father, we have discussed this issue of running microphones into the theater. Will you ask the gentleman to please keep quiet? In a town meeting, we expect in a town meeting some decent manners and this kind of breaking up of the proper course of things. I would suggest he go out and hiss the weather.
Father Drinan, I told you you were going to have to behave yourself.
Now I think, no hissing, no hissing. I think now is a good time. Actually, I suppose the saving grace of our lives always has been humor. And Margaret Barbero from Columbia, Missouri, who listens to National Town Meeting on the radio, has sent this in. I think, to Howard, you'll enjoy it particularly. It's a clipping that she sent in, and it reads, President Nixon called a hasty news conference on the banks of the Potomac. The presidential yacht Sequoia was moored in midstream. To the amazement of the White House press corps, the president walked across the Potomac and stepped aboard the yacht. Next day, the Washington Post headlined, Nixon can't swim. And the final line is, that joke came from an informed Republican source. Now, there's a lovely fact. Now, I was starting to say that once in an address, I heard a sentence that it was the duty of the press to be skeptical about the government, and the duty of the people to be skeptical about both. Now, I ask our panel if this doesn't have, I think, great merit, that the people have a responsibility not to take as gospel everything that they hear on television and radio or read in the press, and they have an affirmative responsibility as free citizens to make up their minds, having acquired all the information that they possibly can. Do you find that valid, Mr. Daly?
I find that very valid, and I think that the government, we should admit and concede, quite frankly, we have a political point of view. We're trying to put the best face on what we're doing. We are politicians. We should be judged as that. Our words should be judged as that. But my contention is that the national news, the national media here in Washington, the Washington Post, should begin as well to be judged as politicians, as individuals with a point of view who are trying to promote their point of view. The only thing we object to, quite frankly, is when the news media attempts to sail, as it were, under really a fraudulent and false flag of neutrality, which it does not deserve.
This question from Emily Simon of New York. To address to Mr. Goodwin, if you deny the necessity of distinguishing between fact and fiction, i.e., the Humphrey headline you mentioned, can the news media exist at all? Are you advocating a Hunter Thompson type? I can't read the name. Bongo or Bonzo journalism? Bongo journalism mixing fantasy and reality. Is this being fair to the American public, Mr. Goodwin?
No, I'm not in favor of fictional journalism. And the headline that I believe that I gave an example was not intended as fiction, but as fact. I think one of the problems that you have is that the even use of the word fact and what constitutes a fact. You're talking about convictions, attitudes, opinions, judgments. These aren't facts in the sense this glass of water is a fact. They require that you impose your own judgment. If somebody says something, is he lying? Does he mean it? Is it true? And simply to say that he said it, in itself is an assertion, at least to people who read it, that perhaps or probably what he said is true. Well, now, it is a fact that he said it, but he may not be speaking facts of the truth. And unfortunately, most things, most interesting or complicated things in the world are not it's not often easy to decide what the facts are without bringing to it a set of values and personal convictions. And if you withdraw from that, you allow those who make the presentation to you to determine what the truth is.
Well, let me interrupt on that. I think that the American people are an intelligent people that when they say that X, Y, and Z said this, whether it's the KKK, as someone mentioned, or a black civil rights leader, or the president, or someone else, the American people are well informed. They're entitled to judge whether what he has to say is valid or invalid, true or false. And so I think that what individuals say, regardless of whether you agree with it or disagree with it, if they're important and prominent, should be reported. As for Hunter Thompson, the term is gonzo journalism, and I think it has its place, and that's in the Rolling Stone and not on the front page of the Washington Post.
Well, I know Mr. Buchanan is a close friend and evening associate of Mr. Thompson, so I appreciate that support. However, it's not so easy as it was in 67 and 68 when the Pentagon is issuing statements on fatalities and enemy casualties and so-called in Vietnam and bombing statistics. And when the reporters know those reports and intelligence reports to be false and misleading, and they have been from 1960 on, and yet to have to print them, so how can the American people judge that the statistics and the body counts and the reports of infiltration are to be true or to be false? That's the reporter's job, certainly not to accept uncritically after years what has been going on. I have a lot of faith in the intelligence of the American people, but the fact is the anti-war movement in this country grew up not as a result of press prodding or information, but almost despite it. And those are the kinds of things, those are facts that are not facts. They sometimes are facts that are lies. Often they're misleading. And to print them straight is there is no automatic corrective mechanism. Common sense doesn't tell you that only one battalion went south instead of three regiments. There's no...
Well, I think that certainly the investigative reporting, if there's inflated and phony body counts in Vietnam, then journalists have an obligation, I think, to report that fact. But I'll just note that when Mr. Goodwin said, Dr. Kissinger said, peace is at hand, that's right, Dr. Kissinger was wrong. It came not 10 weeks later. I would suggest that was a good deal more accurate than when Mr. McNamara, in the administration which Mr. Goodwin served, said in 1965, we'll have the boys home by Christmas.
Well, I think it was a good deal more accurate. Of course, McNamara was expressing a prophecy, Kissinger a fact.
Well, Kissinger's fact came true 10 weeks later, which is not a bad record when we consider the records of some of the other administrations and some of the other statements with regard to the war in Vietnam.
I'm not trying to say you invented all of this, Pat. You know,
I think
the truth of the matter is the troops are home and the prisoners are home, and it was done under Richard Nixon and not under the administrations that took us into Vietnam.
Mr. Asher, and then let us conclude with this. I think we've discussed this in some depth, and you all can make your minds up from the discussion, Mr. Asher.
In terms of talking about the press, it seems to me to be not very illuminating to find out whose lies were reported more studiously.
The fact is, they were all reported,
and they were all reported as facts, and that's something to keep in mind.
Well, if I may, as the moderator, which I guess suggests that I'm full of moderation, although I doubt it, I would think that in a discussion of this kind, the word lies is rather unnecessary. Certainly there is a mental risk. I would also say that hissing is unnecessary. I've researched the town meeting concept. I've researched the town meeting concept pretty thoroughly. In fact, I've participated in many of them up in New Hampshire and one or two in California. And one of the things they seemed to have was some decent manners. This did not mean you could not express your opinion. But they were not vulgar, and they acted decently and properly in a public assembly. Now, I think lies are wonderful things. What is a lie to one person is not a lie necessarily to another. There is, as all of you know who have studied philosophy, a mental reservation. Would you mind sitting down? We'll get you a ticket to the play later, perhaps. I think that there is a mental reservation, and to lay a charge of lie directly down is, I think, unworthy and probably unwise. There is no complete virtue in any of us, and it would be pretty well to respect the motives of anybody else unless you can really declare without any question that what you know to be true. Now, Mr. Asher has made the point. Mr. Asher is a member of the legal profession. And if we were to get into the need to bend fact, not to lie, but to bend fact in the best interests of a client, we would probably spend several days here. So I think in all of our lives, this is true, and that our language should be, I think, perhaps constrained in the recognition that it's barely possible we might be wrong, although we're not necessarily. Now, here's a question for Mr. Harwood, and I think it brings up another facet of what we're trying to discuss and will discuss inadequately in the time we have, although public broadcasting has been nice enough to say we can run over a bit. In view of your opposition, Mr. Harwood, to publishing secret grand jury testimony, why then did the Post publish for 11 consecutive days grand jury testimony in Jack Anderson's column? That question is from Daniel Luto, Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania.
I'm not aware that we published grand jury testimony for 11 straight days. I am aware that after the fact, I believe that Anderson was quoting from grand jury testimony, but I'm not aware of 11 days. Is the question, would I have printed the column if I had known it was from grand jury testimony? And... I suspect we would.
Well, I just ask a question on that. If I'm not mistaken, you said you felt it was unethical, and Mr. Goodwin said it was illegal to penetrate the secrecy of the grand jury, do you think it was unethical to have done so, than to have printed the consequences of it, which were clearly stated in Mr. Anderson's columns?
Well, these things are tough, Pat. What you would... Well, they are difficult. What you would, you know, authorize a reporter on your own staff to do, and what you do with another man, an independent contractor's copy, who... there are a little different questions.
I would agree, frankly, quite frankly, they are difficult decisions. Like the individuals, I think, who leaked material from House Judiciary when they were bound by secrecy quite obviously violated the rules of the committee. But the reporters who get this material, then, if it's newsworthy, in my judgment, of course, that didn't involve a legal, I don't think it involved an ethical thing on their part. They would, I think they have a right to publish it. These are, incidentally, these are not, that particular question is not a simple question, even from the government side of the case, I don't think.
No, it's a very involved issue. But I was hoping there we could draw the difference between the newspaper reporter working for a newspaper and the columnist, and I think we've done it. Some of our audience seem to be concerned that I make it very clear that Father Drynan was not present here today, that was another reference. Now, there are some of you who have complained because you haven't got microphones out there. Mr. Fred Dutton, who is the originator of the National Town Meeting and holds it all together, says that those who want to discuss the format meet Frederick Dutton in the lobby afterwards, right out there. Now, Mr. Buchanan, this is directed to you. Do criticisms of established interests, i.e. government and business, through adversarial relationships, act as an important mechanism in a process of necessary social change? That's from David Rosso of California.
Right. I think, quite frankly, business is not, and neither is government, immune from criticism. My contention is with regard to business. I think it's true that government certainly does have an opportunity to present its own case. But I do think with regard to the business community that their case, especially on the networks, which, as you yourself stated, Mr. Daly, tends to be the front page of the Washington Post, I don't think the front page of the Washington Post really provides the business community with a fair and an open hearing, and I don't think that in this day and age the networks do either.
Anybody else like to go to that question? Please, this, you have some cards if you want. I'm not Mr. President, but thanks very much. I'm not even a chairman. I'm only a moderator. Mr. Asher.
I think that there's something that's become an increasingly prevalent phenomenon called editorial advertising, advocacy advertising. The oil companies no longer sell oil. They sell their views on a variety of political subjects. The Washington Post carries full-page ads from major oil companies, electric utilities, other firms telling us their views about major issues such as strip mining, such as the energy crisis, such as a variety of consumer questions. Mobil Oil Company has the op-ed page in the New York Times, or one quarter of the op-ed page in the New York Times, I think, every Thursday to express its views on the important issues of the day. To the extent that the press's performance bears out Mr. Buchanan's charge that it's biased against the views of these big businesses, something that I am very dubious about, but to the extent that it does, it would be warranted, because these folks get their views out in their own words, in their own format, whenever they want. They just put up the money and buy in.
Well, let me just comment on that. I would suggest that these companies don't spend millions of dollars for issue advertising. They would not spend it if they weren't for the fact that their views were not getting across in the news columns. Now, my opinion of a newspaper is that both sides, or the various sides of the case, ought to be presented in the news columns in the front page, and that no individual in the society should have to resort to buying advertising if he's got a strong, vehement point of view to get it across.
Let me also suggest something in this area, just to see if anybody wants to take it on. As I view the whole spectrum of our daily lives, the newspapers, our government, our corporations, labor unions, do not all of them, including specifically ourselves, when we modestly describe our abilities, put our best foot forward. Now, the issue then is, does a forum exist to put the best foot forward? And we do have a free press. Last time I looked, it was probably getting freer than it had been in some of our earlier history. And we do have, in radio and television, a very broad understanding in the general public of how to get on it. I If you will remember in the 1968 conventions, I believe that Mr. Rubin and the leadership of the demonstrations in Chicago on the morning after the convention said, we have had a very successful week. You see, we know how to manipulate the media. Now, I do think it would be unfair to not make the attempt to get to the public forum yourself and then complain because it's not there and available to you. I think the basic question here is, do forums exist and can they be reached? And if they can be, then I think the subjective initiative and the ability to gather support under yourself becomes critical. Would you disagree with that, Dick? You were in the middle of...
When you talk about television and large newspapers, you're talking not about people, whether they speak for the business community, they are the business community, and they're an aspect of it. They're large corporations. It's very difficult to me to look at the current, what's happening to consumer environmental legislation, the current kind of reversals, the process of inflation, what's happening to interest rates, what's happening to tax reform, and worry about the power and the inability of a major business in America to assert itself and have its views felt. And I set those forth as objective facts, you know. I mean, I think that once in a while when they get a little too extravagant, they do take some heat from the press. But in fact, they have done very well under Democrats and Republicans alike, and it's been the public interest that's had the greatest difficulty in asserting itself, and still does, as the current course of legislation in American history is clear, proven, demonstrated, to say nothing of what's happened to the blacks, the poor, the disadvantaged, who seem to have lost all voice altogether in their struggles in the last 5 or 6 years.
Here is a rather large question, and I think it forms the basis for some discussion. It's from Kay Russell of Kalamazoo, Michigan. The public has been saturated with information and ideas from the news media. Do you really think that this gives them the depth of background they need to form intelligent opinions? Now, I think that's an important question. Who'd like to start it? Would you start it, Mr. Howard?
Well, we start every day with a finite news hole in the newspaper. And we can never publish the volume of material we'd like to because of limitations on space, one. A newspaper is produced every day, and it usually happens between the hours of, primarily between the hours of 5 in the evening and 8 at night. And decisions are made very rapidly. Stories are written very rapidly. They're edited very rapidly. Unquestionably, in the course of that process, our selection of information, our evaluation of information, comes a cropper very often. I suspect in part it's in the nature of the business, but do we give people enough information on which to, you know, manage their lives and make great decisions? Probably not.
I think, quite frankly, that newspapers do an infinitely better job, quite frankly, than television networks, upon which, as I mentioned, 60% of the American people depend. The Post or the Times can go into depth on an issue. They can get men who can become specialists, say, in the energy crisis. But the nature of television, especially network television, upon which so many Americans depend, to try to explain the nuances in the and all that's involved in an energy crisis in the Middle East, I think the record of failure on sophisticated issues and on complex issue is much higher in the networks for the imperatives of how they have to present a program and the fact they use a handful of reporters. You take Mr. Shore, Mr. Rather, 3 or 4 reporters appear regularly. They simply cannot be experts in all these varied issues in a complex society, and you cannot present complex issues in a matter of minutes on national television. So I think that, my judgment, the newspapers, especially the large national newspapers, do a far, far better job, and I would quite frankly be far happier if the American people, in making their judgment about these issues, read newspapers in depth than if they relied upon the networks for their information before they decide an issue as complex as, say, the ABM or the energy crisis.
Dasher, you want to comment there?
I couldn't agree more, which may make my rest of my comments suspect. You have
takes care of your credibility.
But the television is a very seductive phenomenon. It isn't even simply a medium. And it seduces people into relying upon it as their primary source of news. The latest poll I saw was 70%, not 60%, Pat. The American people claim that they get most of their news, the predominant source of their news information is from television. Television's seductive in another way because it's got a video element, too. It makes things look a little bit truer than they really are. You see pictures. You know, if someone talks about pollution, you see it coming out of the smokestack. If someone talks about corruption, you see a picture of a man with his hand in a cash box. Right, it's right there. It's corrupt. And it's easy. You don't have to do any work. And I think that if the American people don't start reading, I mean, the amount of information around is expanding enormously. I think a number of newspapers are not doing a bad job of getting a lot of it out. But it takes a lot of digging. A lot of it is on page D34 of the Washington Post, and not many folks get back there. And I think that the reliance on television, because it's so easy, because it's so seductive, is leading to gross oversimplification of most of the issues around, and tremendous amount of manipulation, especially by those who can get a hold of television easily. And unfortunately, it's the administration and industry, for the most part, who can do it most effectively and regularly.
Well, I think here again, if I may, having worked as an electronic news executive for some time, we had a different view. Now, my colleagues are essentially print media, and we've always had this argument as between the electronic and the print field. My feeling has always been that first radio, and then with the coming of television, radio and television, raised the threshold of public interest in the whole sphere of news very markedly and materially, and sent them to their newspapers to find out more about what they had learned in this front page presentation of the basic network or individual station news program on radio and or television. Notably, while there has been a reduction of numbers in newspapers as such, I believe readerships, and Mr. Harwood will correct me if I'm wrong, readerships have increased. And I always felt myself that you have to take information media in the whole, that if radio and then radio and television together have indeed caused more people to be interested in what is on the front page and in the front news section of a newspaper, then a very major contribution has been made to the nation. A better informed public is really the basis of all of our hopes for the future. Now, if anybody in print media would like to deny that this is even a possibility, I'll leave the stage quietly. I'm not combative. Now, Mr. Harwood speaks of the promise of freedom of the press given in the Constitution. But what makes a press free? Is it only the absence of governmental regulation or, like the court has ruled for business and industry, must real competition among newspapers in the same community exist for freedom of the press in America to be a fact of life? That's from Catherine Pitchell, I think it is, from Arlington, Virginia.
There are two questions. The issue of the constitutional freedom of the press is quite unrelated to the public interest in competing newspapers. The fact is that various numbers have been put around here today, but it's basically true that in only 40 or 50 cities in America do you have competing newspapers serving those audiences. How long those 40 or 50 will survive in a competitive situation, I don't know. I suspect that 10 years from now we'll have fewer cities. The economics of this business are such that communities will not support great numbers of newspapers. And in most cities, they won't even support two. I think cities like St. Louis, where Mr. Buchanan is from, where they have not gone into a monopoly situation, they've gone into business arrangements that enable them to use the same printing facilities and so forth. It's a labor-intensive industry. The costs of production are enormous. And especially if you attempt to put into your newspaper something beyond comic strips and ads and try to build the staff and insufficient quality and numbers to do the job people deserve. It's extremely costly. Is there any remedy for this situation in sight? I honestly don't know if we're talking in terms, again, of these metropolitan dailies. In all communities, suburban papers are growing up and small community papers, but they're not. It's not the same thing. I don't know of any answer to it. I honestly don't, and I think if the as the Justice Department moves on the cross-ownership of broadcasting properties, that the economic resources of some of these newspaper companies will be even less.
Well, let me make a brief point on that. I concur that one of the central problems is the monopoly. I think when I grew up in Washington, there were four papers in the city, and now there are two, and as I mentioned, the Post dominates the morning. I think this monopoly position imposes really an obligation on those that enjoy it, like the Post in Washington, I think, really to open up their news columns, to consciously seek out reporters who have a different perspective, individuals, say, who would not only have Buchanan's perspective, but Goodwin's perspective, who's on the other side, I think, of the Post, so that then, and I think if this happens, I think the New York Times makes an effort in this direction when it sets up its op-ed page and invites dissenting points of view from its editorial columns to appear right there. I think it really sees the responsibility and it tends to try to meet it. I think when this sort of thing, if this sort of thing is encouraged and done, not only in the editorial pages, but in the news column, so that newspapers become sort of an institution where that it have a broad spectrum of opinion reporting the national news, I think that a lot of the criticism on the part of politicians and other journalists will tend to diminish.
Goodwin? I just wanted to say, I think that, I mean, there are possible alternatives. I know in Boston, where the Globe, which I regard as a good newspaper, has come to dominate the city, has been the growth of the so-called alternative press, the Boston Phoenix and the Real Paper, which have some excellent reporting in them, which are economically self-sufficient, but more upon have a profound effect on the Globe itself, which reads them. The Globe, for example, is inclined towards supporting the mayor of the city of Boston, maybe a little inclined to overlooking the peccadilloes of the city officials of Boston. But the pressure from these other papers often forces or persuades them into investigations. There can be no substitute for competition by having one man decide he's going to represent six points of view, because the atmosphere and the inclinations of the paper penetrate its entire staff. And I think encouragement of the growth of these alternatives, which I think are economic, and perhaps through the tax structure, others, because some kind of incentive was given, might produce a situation in which no one's going to compete with the Boston Globe or the Washington Post economically, but they can get good people out on the streets with the resources to do the job that will challenge those papers constantly to a different kind of level.
Right. Yes, Tom? Just one quick point. I think that Dick is right, that competition is essential, and that there are some hopes to seeing some competition arising in the print media in the future over the strenuous opposition of labor. In fact, printing a newspaper is becoming less labor-intensive. It can be done by computers. You don't have to have the massive staffs, which is why you're having a lot of strikes now. I think that the prod of competition is excellent, but I think that Pat Buchanan makes a good point that we might consider for a moment, and that is that as long as we're stuck with monopoly daily newspapers, and we are in most communities, would it not be a good idea to have the White House covered by someone who at the head of the column was an avowed disliker of Mr. Nixon and his policies and an avowed liker of Mr. Nixon and his policies? Let them both report the same incident, the same news conference, the same facts. And I think it would be very illuminating for people to read those two columns side by side and see how far the truth might lie in between two different perspectives.
Here, here.
There is, I'm sure, in many minds, as well as Mr. Ash's, new concepts of how things can be done, but I think probably it is still vitally important that we let the editors of the newspapers run their own newspapers, giving them the benefit of our good advice. Now, I have just learned something, you know, that all these years I've been in the business, I understand now what this question's all about. We have a question from Lillian Spiro of Fairfax, Virginia, and she says, when will the news media give more coverage to programs of this nature? That's a very good question. And I'm sorry to say our time has expired, as they put it. Actually, it's more than expired. We're 15 minutes beyond our scheduled time already. So we must close the forum with the hope that you have found this a fruitful and interesting use of your morning. Next, thank you.
Thank you. Next Wednesday morning, July 17th, the National Town Meeting will take up the energy problem and the environment with Senator Edmund Muskie of Maine and Federal Energy Chief John Sawhill. The two press questioners would be James Bishop, energy and environmental writer for Newsweek magazine, and Thomas O'Toole, science reporter for the Washington Post. The following Wednesday, July 31st, the topic will be Perspective on Detente with Senator J. William Fulbright and another speaker to be announced next week. To those of our radio audience, we invite you to send in questions. Just address them to the National Town Meeting, Kennedy Center, Washington, D.C. This series is broadcast by National Public Radio and is made possible by a grant from the Mobile Oil Corporation. If any of you listening plan to be in Washington Wednesday next, come to the Kennedy Center, say, about 10:15 a.m. and join us. The more, the merrier. Good day and a good tomorrow.
Thus, the conclusion of the fifth in this series of National Town Meetings. The title was Critiquing the Media. The speakers were Patrick Buchanan, a speechwriter and assistant to President Nixon, Richard Goodwin, who formerly was a speechwriter and assistant to the late President Kennedy and now is an editor of the publication Rolling Stone, Richard Harward, the national affairs editor of the Washington Post, and Thomas Asher, a director of the Media Access Project.